Hi everyone, producer Bryn here. This is the first of two episodes from the vaults, so to speak. Some brilliant episodes recorded earlier in the year that we didn't release at the time. So some of the details will be a little bit out of date, particularly Stephen's references to the Managing Drug and Alcohol Problems in Primary Care conference that took place in March. So if you're interested in attending this, and why wouldn't you be after this episode, keep an eye out for details on the 2024 conference. Anyway, enough from me. Enjoy the pod.
Welcome back to the Somewhere in Between podcast for First Five and GP trainees, brought to you by the RCGP, joined by the wonderful LJ. And the two of us today are going to bookend a fantastic episode brought to you by Hatim, who had the absolute delightful job of interviewing Dr. Stephen Willett, who is a inner city GP with a specialist interest in drug and alcohol in Nottingham. So sit back, relax, have a listen, and we will see you on the other side.
So Stephen, when I reached out to you, and the reason I reached out to you is because you have a fascinating portfolio. So I think it'd be really helpful for our listeners to understand what that looks like for you and the various roles that you have.
With pleasure. So first and foremost, I am an inner city GP. I'm the senior partner, actually, of the Windmill practice. Not that that means anything. But that has led to other things. So you can't, I think, be an inner city GP, certainly in a place with huge deprivation as the Windmill practice, and not come across lots of people with drug and alcohol problems and homelessness. So I have then sort of developed some interest and learned experience on those issues. I also work as a GP for the homeless at a homeless day centre once a week, and the other session that I do for them is joining in with a really interesting group on severe multiple disadvantage, or SMD as it's known. And so that started with the Everyone In campaign, and actually we have sort of carried on, because you know there should be in 2023 no reason for why so many people should remain homeless, and yet they are. So that's another role. And then almost there, I am the clinical lead for drugs and alcohol. I work with public health, so I'm actually an employee of the city council in that regard, because that's where that's based these days. And then finally, I chair the national conference of the RCGP on managing drug and alcohol problems in primary care. But more of that later.
How did you find your way into this space, into these roles? As you mentioned, part of it was working in an inner city GP practice and the people that you care for. But what really drove your interest and fascination in this area? Was it kind of a matter of being in the right determined interest in this space before you entered work as a GP?
Well, you know, you don't exactly plan things how they work out, do you? Any more than someone with a serious drug problem plans to be a heroin addict. You know, it happens. But actually, I worked with a GP who was further along the road than me. And I learned from him, and I was just so impressed with his approach, his kindness to people with drug and alcohol problems, and helping them to cope with their addiction. I think that it was really important to sort of think, okay, yeah, that's something that I can do. You know, maybe I am a little bit stigmatizing of people with these problems and so on. And then this lovely, lovely guy went and died. And I was very much left sort of holding the baton for the practice in that regard. All of the GPs in the practice do work and have some experience on drug and alcohol issues, but it was important to perhaps have a champion. So I became that champion.
Did you, as you started to do that role, did you feel like you needed some additional education and training, or was it something that you just gained by experience? And then and really reflecting on this question, as we think about people that might be listening and are looking to develop their skills or understanding in this area, what would you advise them based on your own experience?
Good question. I think it's important to have a basic level of understanding. I think there should be far more in the undergrad curriculums and certainly in the registrar curriculum. We regularly go into our Nottingham scheme and talk about drug and alcohol problems ship in some folks with lived experience to boost that. But I think it's actually important to have some extra experience as well, much as you know, we go on courses for diabetes and so on, don't we? Because things change. Well, actually, we need to do that for drug and alcohol too. And there are courses that you can get via the RCGP. They're actually run by Spectrum, a SLD organization at the moment. But they're getting increasingly of a really good quality. And of course, the other thing is the conference that are run that is a really good exposure to things like that. You know, we should all be able to handle someone and signpost someone with a problem with alcohol, say, because it's just so commonplace, and with almost 25% of our population of adults drinking more than the recommended amounts. So we should all be able to do that. But I think it requires a greater degree of expertise to be able to determine whether someone has a binge problem or a dependency, and what you might do about that, and what the options are. But we can also, all of us, signpost to and encourage to a specialist organization, which every area has, because it's, you know, it's just important that there is an offer for someone at whatever level they are at on their on the spectrum of alcohol and drug problems.
That brings me on nicely to a question that one of my co-hosts had, Mira, was often there are difficulty in terms of accessing detoxification or rehab type services, and there may be certain barriers that might be the cost of living crisis, for example. Are there any practical tips that you would give GPs in terms of supporting patients on that journey?
Several come to mind. I mean, I think, first of all, kindness, you know, because you don't want to sort of tell someone off for coming and asking for help. No, it's not at all likely to be appropriate to give someone a Friday night script of some diazepam or Claudia's epoxide. But it is likely to be able to say, look, it's really good that you've come and you want to tackle this. You know, often they've had this problem for a long while, and so it doesn't, generally speaking, require a same-day solution. And actually, if they're saying, look, I'm withdrawing, I need help now, then actually the answer probably is for them to have a drink. But to say that kindly and with some suitable signposting makes a big deal of difference. As regards the detox options, I think it is dependent on what your the offer is in your area. I'm pleased to say that that Nottingham Recovery Network in the city, you know, has a same day access. So you can, I can tell someone, look, if you go there now, or if you call them now, you will start the ball rolling on your journey of doing, of recovery, of trying to do something about this. And I think it's important actually that a GP doesn't feel they're opening a can of worms that they then can't deal with, that there needs to be some backup. So it's not likely to be the GP that needs to find the solution to a detox center. And indeed, it's not often the best immediate solution, because it achieves nothing if you do a detox and then a week later that person is drinking. So it has to be the right time, at the right place, the right people involved. It's complicated, and that generally does need a greater degree of working up. But I come back to the point that GPs are in a really key place. They are trusted healthcare professionals. And if you are able to help them on that journey, rather than them feel that they're getting the cold shoulder treatment, that can make all the difference. Because people are often a window of opportunity. There is a reason why they suddenly want help now, and I think we need to be in a position to respond to that nicely.
That's really great to hear, and it's good to hear that the services are in a good place in Nottingham. How important do you think it is that GPs play roles as champions to help develop and input into those services? And tell us a bit about your role with the council.
It's hugely important. I mean, we've had this whole journey, haven't we, with sort of CCGs, PCNs and ICSs and whatever. And GPs are really key with all of that. At the council, I am the sort of the clinical voice, if you like, to the those commissioners making decisions about drug and alcohol services. And I'm really pleased that our council, does give credence to that opinion. One other area is that we have in Nottingham still, and is, I'm sad to say, a slightly dying breed, is shared care. What I mean by that is clinics that are run, and we have one on 4 days of every Monday to Friday at the Windmill practice for people with quite entrenched drug addiction problems that often require them to be on a script like methadone or buprenorphine. And for a aging sort of cohort of people who use drugs, it's really important that there is this option of being cared for in primary care. Why? For several reasons. Because one, it's certainly less stigmatizing. You are in the waiting room along with everyone else. No one knows what you are specifically there for. It feels like you're getting, a general NHS sort of treatment. Secondly, that I, unlike specialist drug services, have access to someone's full medical notes. And so I can see exactly where they're at with their Hep C treatment or with their chronic breathing difficulty from years and years of smoking, and so on and so forth. So I think that shared care is a really important tool or option that we have to try our best to hang on to. And again, that sort of comes into that liaison with the city council. I'm also as chair of the local drug death group, as it's known. There's a slightly posher term for it, but essentially, looking into what happens when someone has a drug-related death and what we can do with that. Some of that comes back to lessons for primary care too, because there are many GPs that are just too profligate with prescribing sedative antidepressants for people who are actively drinking. That's dangerous, and it's certainly not likely to be doing much good. Or similarly, co-prescribing of other medications such as amitriptyline, and it's often a whole cocktail of medication prescribed and illicit that causes someone's death.
That's fascinating. And there's clearly a lot of history in terms of dependence in terms of prescribing and polypharmacy around not just sedative medications, but opioid medications, for example. Yeah. And so how do we be better as GPs in terms of managing that? And how do you have those conversations? Because it can be quite challenging and daunting to feel like you're going to have a conversation with a patient around maybe stopping certain prescribed medications when they have historically been prescribed for many years.
You're right. I'm not going to pretend that that's easy. Unfortunately, it is always much easier to say yes than no, isn't it? But many patients will thank us for actually working with them, not pulling the rug from underneath their feet, but working with them on a tapering sort of program for particularly opioids and benzos and other drugs. Because, you know, the evidence of long-term opioids for pain relief is really not there. It's pretty awful. And yet there are so many people on maintenance, big doses of opioids. So, you know, I think that we do have to find some good solutions for that, and perhaps increasingly work with the growing army of pharmacists in our practices. But also, you know, this is another reason to get some specialist training in addiction, so that you are better able to help folks with these problems and these addictions.
That's really helpful. And then you've motivated me to go and do some extra development in this area too. So that's definitely something I'm going to be doing for my own appraisal. I had a question around digital transformation. So I'm a big fan of digital transformation, but I feel it needs to be safe and ethical. And we've seen lots of changes in ways of working as a result of the pandemic. How has that impacted the community that you look after in the essence of homelessness, but also in the essence of people that are struggling with drug and alcohol addiction? And the reason I ask this question is because I had an assumption that actually it probably may make care more difficult for individuals. But at the same time, I remember hearing a story about a patient who actually found it better to be speak to their GP over the phone because it was less stigmatizing in terms of not necessarily being in front of someone, not having to go into a practice or into a waiting room. They found it much more easier to access and have that conversation over the phone. So what are your perceptions on this and its role in the future?
Well, I think we have to work towards better range of digital options. It will still be a huge inequalities issue because the most chaotic individuals either end up, you know, through Maslow's levels, pawning their phone or losing it or whatever. And so, you know, then it often becomes a non-starter. Our homeless and street outreach services often have and throughout the whole lockdown period had a supply of sort of, you know, 10 quid phones that they could hand out and just helping people to still get access to healthcare. Yes, you know, telephone and video consultations have been useful, and sometimes you can do those third party. I have done consultations with people either literally on the street or on the street via their key worker where I've been in the health centre. And so sometimes, you know, an advocate can really help there. Maybe we should make better use of pharmacies in that regard. I'm sure there are better options, and there is a whole spectrum of sort of need. There will be many people who can access apps and so on their phone, and so for them it's really sensible that we have a sort of a few options up our sleeve of good apps for helping them monitor their drinking or other drug use to sort of help them to get some support and so on. So there is a huge digital option that we really shouldn't that we should embrace. But I would just encourage you to think, hang on, does this work for the most needy? And indeed, you know, those who are illiterate and struggle with technology.
And I think that's where we are really fortunate as GPs to be able to have relationships with people that are continue, and to be able to understand what people's needs might be and be able to take some time to over a period of time understand what people's needs might be and what might be best for them, and then create a model of access that works for everyone. It's not easy, particularly in the current challenges, but I would say we should be really mindful of what works for some people and what works for others, and make sure we're not excluding people from care or access.
Agree.
So I guess the next question I had was, there will be people that, as you mentioned, through training, haven't really had enough experience. And yes, we can go and do your online learning modules, and I think that is important to be able to upskill ourselves in an effective manner. But some of us might be looking for hands-on opportunities to get experience in this space. Do you have any tips or that you would give people in terms of trying to get hold of those hands-on opportunities, and what kind of groups to reach out to?
Well, it's hard to come up with examples that will work nationally. I suppose one of the huge benefits of the conference that I run is that it is not just listening to some excellent speakers, but it's networking. It's finding out, you know, meeting people from other areas around the country and thinking what could be done in my patch. Or indeed, you might meet someone who is just in your patch and so on that you could get together with. The specialist courses that to become a what's known as, you know, gypsy in alcohol or drug terms does mean doing a course where you are actually sat round with others and you do have to follow some cases and that sort of thing as part of your homework. And you know, I guarantee you that everyone who's working in primary care and listening to this will have come across people with alcohol and other drug problems. If you haven't, then you're not asking the right questions or sort of got your radar on, you know, that they are commonplace. And therefore, all of us can just start to develop some experience. And it's almost certain that you will have someone in your practice or that you connect with where that you could actually say, look, do you mind if I just discuss this with you, much as we do our sort of debriefs and so on, so we can learn from each other. And I'm not, you know, I don't have all the answers. I frequently come across a conundrum that is just better shared with another GP who I respect. So I think we can all do that. And I was just going to mention, I don't know whether you've seen it, Hatim, but on the iPlayer BBC, that there was that hour programme, I'm an Alcoholic, recently, that was actually just a window into the AA movement, and it was incredibly well done and enlightening. And even if, you know, our patients or we as GPs don't feel that that higher power type idea is the way that we might want to go, that there are contemporary sort of alternatives like smart recovery. There are open meetings for these things, and you can actually go along to one. I mean, I've been to a couple of AA meetings, and they're really interesting. But at the very least, I encourage you to listen to that BBC thing whilst it's available. And think about attending one. And certainly while I'm on the subject, you know, have an idea of what is available in your area. I guarantee you there will be an AA meeting that is local to wherever you are.
That's really helpful. And what we'll do is we'll make sure that we signpost to that, as well as any other useful resources through the link that comes along with the podcast, so that it can make it easy access to reach some of this material and then upskill yourself. Because I think what you said there is really important in terms of understanding people's lived experience and being able to learn from that. And there are many different ways of doing that. And you're right, I would very much be surprised if anyone hasn't had some sort of experience or encounter. And like you said, if you haven't, then you aren't asking the right questions. And actually, you know, you should be using your prompts on your screen when you're in practice to be able to ask the right questions anyway, particularly around alcohol. I think that would be a takeaway point for anyone that hasn't been able to do that. Tell us a bit more about this conference in the new year and kind of when is it? Where is it being held and what kind of things will it be covering?
It's the 16th to 17th of March at the Royal College GPs, 30 Euston Square. And so easy to get to. This year is the first in the past 3 years that we've actually managed to have it back face to face. Having said that, it would be a hybrid event, so that if it's not possible for you to get there, then you can still join the conference online. You know, it's just if you possibly can go, I would encourage you to do that because that then gives that those networking options. We're also planning to sort of get in some other creative sort of interest at the end of between the 2 days, the end of day one. Then we're probably going to get some poets from those who, from learned experience, have found that a good avenue to describe their experiences. Also, there's a really interesting tapestry that's going to come up with lots of stories and possibly some dance. But the main body of the conference is having some experts in the field. So the national speaker. So, for example, we've got a fella from the States, Keith Humphreys, who's a huge bigwig, has advised, you know, Barack Obama's government and so on drug problems. And he's talking to us about the opioid crisis in North America and actually how we're sort of heading that direction here, as many of us GPs are aware, in terms of the growing number of those with prescription dependencies, and actually what can we do about it. We've got the likes of Professor Adam Winstock, who is just a tour de force himself and able to communicate really well on a whole range of drug and alcohol issues, encouraging us to have honest conversations with our patients. There's not just alcohol and other drug problems. We dip into behavioral stuff, so some gaming, some gambling. Got Claire Gerada will giving us an update on what's happening gambling and what the options are in primary care. But there are also some sessions where, you know, we really encourage a lot of interaction, that there'll be sort of some more workshop type parallel sessions too. Something for sort of those who don't have a huge amount of experience, as well as those that do, and all learning together. What we have found is that almost 50% of attendees in the last 2 or 3 years have actually been those who are there for the first time, and actually a lot of younger GPs and GP registrars and so on. So I think it's a good sort of window to actually understand what is going on, and actually, you know, at the end of the day, behavioral change is an awful lot of general practice, whether that's talking to someone with a weight problem, chocolate addiction, or whatever. So, you know, I encourage you to have a look at it. How would you find it? Well, you'll probably be bombarded with emails if you are an RCGP member. Otherwise, if you Google sort of drug alcohol conference RCGP 2023, you will find it. But I will certainly give you a link to go out with the podcast.
Thanks, Stephen. That would be fantastic. And what sounds like a fascinating event. And for those that are still in training, remember, this is something that you can potentially have your study budget allocated to through a conversation with your supervisors. And we'll link to many curriculum outcomes that we've just talked about are very difficult to gain when you're in practice, particularly around drug and alcohol addiction and mental health. And so it'd probably be really worth attending. But actually, like you said, the motivational behavioral change type consulting models and practice is actually relevant to any consultation that you might do.
Well, you're not wrong. And just picking up on the mental health, I mean, that is a huge one. I mean, the overlap between mental health and drugs, and it works both ways, and alcohol, of course. And actually, we've got a session dedicated to how can we do that better, that comorbidity of mental health and alcohol and drug use. We've also, one last plug is we've got Professor Sir Ian Gilmore, who is no lightweight on the subject of alcohol related harm, and an MP, Dan Carden, talking about what Parliament's doing, but also his own lived experience.
Well, that's fantastic. I mean, it sounds like a fascinating event. And from a networking point of view, for those that are interested in this area, it would be a no-brainer to attend. But also for those that are looking to develop more learning in this area, again, it's also a no-brainer. I'm going to bring us to a close because, Stephen, your time is really valuable. But I have a couple of more things just to ask before we do go. And when we did first connect, I did have a slight interest in learning a little bit more about the use of cannabis in healthcare, particularly because I sit on a committee for NICE that looks at new technologies. And when I say new technologies, it tends to be new medications. And one of the medications that we've been reviewing in the past is cannabidiol for conditions like tuberous sclerosis. And I've also had patients kind of come to me and ask me about this and its use. And so this was actually a question again proposed by Mira, our co-host. Often when patients come to us about cannabis and whether it can be prescribed or whether it's something that should be recommended, and not just typical cannabis, but also or medicinal cannabis, but also CBD type over-the-counter type treatments that people might try. How would you manage those situations? What is the most up-to-date advice that you would suggest to give to people when people come to you with these questions?
I can't give you a 30-second neat answer on that, except to say that this is a very much a changing field. I think that cannabis generally is one of the least dangerous drugs that we somehow have just a ridiculous sort of you know, middle class sort of, oh no, can't possibly have used something that is illicit. You know, it's arbitrary why it's illicit. Alcohol is the most dangerous drug when you include all the harms to society. So I think we've got things all wrong. Nevertheless, there are some harms, particularly because it is generally smoked, and that's an issue. And if you can disentangle the smoking from the cannabis, that's more obviously recreational use, then that would be good. And there are safer ways to take it. As regards more medicinal use, yes, I think that there is a huge sort of thing for us to continue to explore there. But the evidence is certainly there. it doesn't neatly come from nice randomized controlled trials, but there is overwhelming experience, not only on the examples you give, but that those with the resistant epilepsy in childhood and so on, that I just think we cannot disregard. And I think certainly a lot safer and better for pain relief than some of the other things that we are using. So I am convinced that there are medicinal uses, and it's not going to be for me to sort of tell patients not to use it. It's not also, sadly, at the moment, for us as GPs to easily prescribe it. Although there was that ruling a couple of years ago that said it was possible, it's still not practically possible for us to write prescriptions for it. So I think we need to clear up this mess and make it a whole lot simpler. But particularly the use of the non-high bit of cannabis, the cannabidiol, I think is a huge option, as indeed there are other currently illicit drugs that could be of use, like the psilocybin and other psychedelics for resistant depression, ketamine and so on for some alcohol treatment. Or, you know, there are lots of options that we in the 21st century need to properly explore. But I'll stop there. Oh, just to mention, drug science that I am part of is really great on this. Professor David Nutt has written widely and is involved in all sorts of exciting trials answering these questions. So it's an evolving space, which I'm excited about.
I agree. It's an evolving space that I think we need to watch and watch carefully and see as the evidence starts to build. And I feel there maybe is a bit more impetus in terms of looking closely at that evidence and building that evidence. And, you know, I've had many patients anecdotally that have done very well on taking over-the-counter CBD type treatment. So it's just important that you do, or we all do, try to consider practicing holistically when we have these conversations with people, but also within our remit as GPs. And as you say, at the moment, it's not something that we can quite easily or typically prescribe. I don't think I've ever been in a situation where I've been asked to prescribe it, but it's something to be mindful of and to be able to have conversations about as the evidence builds. Well, what a fascinating conversation. I think our listeners are in for a treat.
Thank you, Hatim. I've enjoyed that.
Same. I have too. Really appreciate your time. And hope we can catch up soon. If our listeners enjoyed, and give us any feedback as well. And we'll post all the relevant links in with the podcast.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back. I hope you enjoyed that episode. I, for one, found it incredibly interesting. Lots to discuss. So, LJ, what were your thoughts?
I really enjoyed this particular episode because it kind of gave a different spin on homelessness general practice that I think you covered in one of your interviews last year. I really liked the sort of how his interest in drugs and alcohol sort of had these overlaps with mental health and homelessness medicine. And also how he sort of developed his experience into skills and then into leadership positions. And I really liked hearing about all those different facets, this particular GP's portfolio.
Yeah, I think it was really interesting to see how he'd sort of got into all of this. And actually it came out of really a place of need, I guess. He's an inner city GP and he sees a lot of drug and alcohol, and therefore, as he described, like, you have to kind of take an interest in this and get involved in it and upskill in it. Otherwise, you're doing a disservice to your patients. And I guess that's the same around the country. Like, we know that one type of medicine doesn't fit all depending on where you work in the UK, which is why care needs to be a lot more locally delivered to meet the needs of the population. And I guess this is an example. And I also thought it was really interesting the way that as a result of that, he's ended up sort of on advisory boards and dealing kind of with the inner city council and it made you realize what a big issue drug and alcohol is and how important it is that people do gain the skills in this, because it's really important for society, not just people and patients in general.
And as part of that, I suppose, how he got to those positions and how he got to those places, I found it really it was interesting how when Hatim asked, like, what can people do specifically, he kind of almost stepped back and said, no, it's about, like, more generically, how do you get these sort of opportunities in terms of, like, networking and meeting people and pursuing the things that you find interesting by, like, attending courses or whatever it is that you do, and then, like, letting things happen organically. And I think that was really telling from the whole interview as it kind of went on, that there was no sort of set pathway to finding yourselves in these sort of positions. If you're interested in something, it will sort of develop. And I really enjoyed sort of hearing his advice about kind of just being open to discuss the things that you're interested in with others.
Yeah. And then find your people, find your network, and and follow your interests. And I think that's what's beautiful, isn't it, about being a GP? Like, obviously I'm about 6 months post CCT, but I mean, you really just have the scope to follow your interests and do whatever interests you. And one by one, you will end up kind of talking to someone who knows someone, and all of a sudden you can find yourself sort of an expert in this, I guess, and lead, you know, in quite an influential role for something that actually interests you and not a job that you're forced to do. So I think that's the beauty of GP, regardless of what you're interested in. I thought it was really interesting from an education perspective. He talked about how there really is a lack of training in drug and alcohol, which I don't know about you, but I totally agree with. My full kind of, in all the years I've been a doctor, I've had very, very little time spent on kind of how to manage these people. And then he also talked about how prevalent it is. And if you don't think you're looking after anyone with a drug and alcohol problem, then you're not asking the right questions, which I also really think is really interesting.
I hope you don't mind my asking, Kim, like sort of turning the interview on you just for this little bit. You just mentioned how, like, you've been a GP now for about 6 months. And, you know, you can develop and follow your interests and stuff. But I expect that in that sort of immediate bit after CCT, there's like everything's up in the air, it's a settling in period. Have you found yourself following interests yet? Or are you sort of settling into post-CCT life?
Oh, yeah, good question, LJ. Yeah, no, I think for me, I probably am a little bit of a yes person. And I think it's very easy to end up kind of filling all your time with things quite quickly. So for me, I just wanted to get used to being a GP, a general GP, and kind of become confident in that role. So I have yet to follow or pick up other roles on the side. I'm just, getting to grips with the kind of day-to-day job. But I definitely know people who know what they want to do, and they've started kind of, you know, getting involved in that already. And I think it's all about what interests you, and also timing to an extent. If an amazing role came along right now, that I was really interested in, then obviously I would take that up. But I think sometimes it's a lot easier to say yes to things and end up involved in things than it is sometimes to get out of something you don't want to be involved in. So I think taking your time and finding your path and just being a bit selective is quite important.
Good. Well, thank you for answering my question. It's a bit nosy and a bit left field. For our listeners, when I asked the question, Kim gave me, I'm not going to say a dirty look, but definitely a look of what you're about to ask me.
I know. Well, no, I mean, I think the time post CCT is a really interesting one. I think you are really thrown into being the life of a GP, and I think it's important that you're kind of in a supportive place and that you've got people to ask questions to, because it's still a learning game, isn't it? Just because you gain a CCT doesn't mean you know everything, far from it. And I certainly don't know a lot about drug and alcohol. And I think, you know, working in London, I work in South London, we've got quite a decent drug and alcohol service in the local community, which also means that as a result, actually, I'm pretty de-skilled because we refer everybody into that centre. So his point about going on the course that he was talking about, and how we all go on diabetes courses, but we don't go on courses on how to manage drug and alcohol, and talking about the polypharmacy and how opiates aren't effective, really kind of my ears perked up, and I thought, oh, Kim, yeah, you definitely need to go on this course and be educated about this.
Sure. And I think that he mentioned about how he doesn't have all the answers himself. He's a GP with special interests, and he's, you know, quite high up in all of those special interests on all these boards and things. And even he says he doesn't have all the answers, and he discusses these cases with GPs that he respects and gets on with. And I think that sort of is really important, even as a trainee, even if someone in my position, feeling happy and open to just discuss cases for cases' sake, just to sort of learn, not necessarily for a portfolio's tick off, but just to sort of widen your horizon and just feel more comfortable talking about things that you might not know very much about. Like I know that I don't know very much about drugs and alcohol. I was quite lucky that in my previous practice where I was rotating, we had a GP with special interest in drugs and alcohol and addictions. And I remember just feeling very like, if I had a patient come and see me, that I can just quickly refer them over to that GP instead, and rather than me sort of dealing with it. And that GP very quickly told me that that wasn't the way to learn, that actually I'm training and, you know, that's I should ask the questions and fail and stumble and then learn from discussing the case afterwards. And I that's something that sort of perked my ears up, because it kind of reminded me of that sort of that nice feeling of being able to discuss cases and being in that sort of environment. And I think that comes from a supportive practice, like you said, like being somewhere where you feel comfortable to learn and ask and things.
Yeah, exactly. And I can think of another topic that scared me kind of as an ST3 was like HRT. People would come in and talk about HRT and I'd dread it. I'd see it on the list and I'd think, oh gosh, no, like I can't, I don't know anything about it. I can't even fake it. I don't know what I'm talking about. I sound like I don't know what I'm talking about. And actually, when I think about it, it is a similar story probably for drugs and alcohol with people that have, you know, truly addiction problems. He's really made me think that, gosh, I really need to go and kind of try and upskill a bit in this area, because it is something I know very little about. And I think also drug and alcohol in particular is an example where continuity really matters. And I think in the current NHS system and with the pressures and things, continuity sometimes takes a bit of a back seat. So you're not doing anyone any favors by kind of giving these people a short supply of cocodamol and each GP kind of doing that. And we make, you know, when someone's got a drug and alcohol addiction, I think we make that easy by you know, we aren't providing perhaps the continuity of care that we used to in the same way. So it's very easy to sort of doctor shop. And actually our system perhaps isn't designed to deal with these patients either. And I think, you know, I do think that it tied in a lot actually to the homeless podcast before Christmas, but, you know, sometimes these patients can be quite challenging and quite demanding, but that, you know, there's ways that you can handle them. And actually they're struggling with an addiction and it's a problem like every other problem that comes into GP, and it's up to us to be able to handle that better and not, you know, expect patients to not come to you with their drug and alcohol problem. So yeah, it really did make me think.
And I think having that sort of systems level awareness of things, something else I picked up from the interview was that interface, not because we talk about primary and secondary care interfaces quite a lot, I think, in terms of referrals and things like that. But actually in this domain, within drugs and alcohol and addictions, there's those sort of third party services or social services and things that you interface with that aren't secondary care as such, and don't have the same sort of format or systems in place that we would see in secondary care. So if you're a GP and you're referring into all these sort of third party or third, like, blah, 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 blah. If you're a GP and you're referring into these sort of community-based third-party services, understanding that interface must be really, really important. And when I was just recently on a psych job, we spoke with our local drugs and alcohol service quite a lot. And it was interesting to see how that wasn't necessarily linked up very well with primary care where I'm training. And I'm really pleased to hear that it's linked up a bit better up in Nottingham and in South London where you are.
Yeah, I think it is. I think there's a good service in London, certainly. And it sounds like, thanks to the hard work of GPs like Stephen, there is a good service in Nottingham as well. But yeah, I think we all come across drug and alcohol problems every day. And actually, he really made a point of, do you have the confidence to ask about it? Like, not everybody's going to come and tell you. And I think in London in particular, actually, there's an awful lot of sort of secret drug and alcohol problems amongst people that you would not expect. And actually, if you don't ask, you won't find out. So, lots of food for thought with this podcast. So any more thoughts, LJ?
None brings fine. No, I really, really enjoyed this this episode, though. Thank you very much to Hatim and to Stephen for the fab interview.
That was a fascinating episode, a fascinating insight into how to get involved in something that you're interested in, how to follow your interests, how that might lead to multiple different specialist roles in that area, and also kind of shedding light on a really important topic that we probably all need to go and upskill ourselves in slightly. So yeah, thank you very much to Stephen, thank you very much to Hatem, and I hope you all enjoyed it.
Hi everyone, welcome back to Somewhere in Between, the AIT and First Five Careers podcast brought to you by the RCGP. So that's like...
Okay, hang on. Hi everyone, welcome back.